Okay.
I am with Christopher Cow. This is Martha Bloomfield. And he's the pastor at the Hmong Alliance, Warren Hmong Alliance Church. And today is October 25th, 2011.
Yes.
I know I explained to you a little bit in my emails, but if I could just explain again what I'm trying to do, because there are actually two different projects here.
Okay.
My background is in gathering stories from people. And I think I mentioned a colleague of mine and I, we did a book on immigrants and refugees to Michigan, which Michigan State University published in 2010. Michigan State University Press has a series of small books, about 80, 90 pages, of different ethnic groups who have come to Michigan. And they already have about 25 of these books, but they haven't covered the different groups of people from the Asian countries. So they asked me to begin with the Hmong people. So this first project is about, it's more the history and an overview of Hmong people coming to Michigan. But my passion is for the stories that people have. And you understood very quickly in my email about the importance of gathering the stories from the, in particular, the elderly people. That would become a second book, really. And I'm talking to one of the professors at Michigan State University about possibly getting some Hmong students to help with the interviews. But I still need some interviews now, and I need to learn about the communities, because people have written about the Hmong in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, in California, but nobody's written anything about Michigan. So maybe first, though, if you could tell me a little bit about yourself, and then we'll move to how you might be able to help me and what you know of this community. Is that
okay? Yeah, happy to. I came here in 1976. Settled in Arkansas, in Jasper, Arkansas, a little town in the Ozark Mountains. And I lived there for half a year with my sponsor. I was so homesick and so lonely. So after a while, I moved to Pennsylvania, where my cousins were living as refugees as well. So settled there, and
in Philadelphia or where?
Well, west of Philadelphia. I was with them for a couple of months, and then I found a job in the Pocono. Is that the Pocono Mountains up north in Pennsylvania on Highway 80 near Stroudsburg. And so there I entered East Stroudsburg College, Teachers College, I think it was called at that time. Later it became East Stroudsburg State University. But I started there. Then when my parents came back, came to the States in September 1979, they settled in Philadelphia. So I moved back into Philadelphia and transferred to Westchester State College, which has later become Westchester State University. my parents and my family live in Philadelphia. No, then at that time, until 1980s, in the winter of 1980s, we moved to Minnesota. And so I've been in Minnesota from 1980 to 2002. Then after 2002, I became a pastor and then served in Sacramento, California for 5 years. Before we came here to Michigan. So we arrived here in Michigan in August 2008. So we have been here just a little bit over 3 years. So that's my
story. What year did you say you came?
1976.
So you were one of the first people then to come?
I think so. To Michigan. No, I did not come to Michigan right away. I went to Arkansas. I didn't come here until to Michigan until 2008.
And how old were you when you went to Arkansas?
Probably 19.
And can you tell me a little bit, I know there's a big story, but a little bit about where you started. Were you in Laos?
Yeah, I was born in Laos. Lived there, grew up there. And we migrated to out of Laos into Thailand. After the fall of the royal government in May 1975. And so we lived there in the refugee camp.
And you went with your whole family, or part of
the family was broken up into groups so that we can cross the river, the Mekong River, into Thailand. My brother, my youngest brother, and I were the first one to cross over. My two sisters and their families cross over before us. But then my youngest brother and I cross over. Then my parents came later, and my oldest brother was the last one to cross over. And along with him was my youngest sister. The youngest sister, because the youngest ones would have come with my parents. I'm sorry, there's many people in the family.
No reason to. I'm here to learn. And then how long were you in which camp were you in, and for how long?
My youngest brother and I, we came to camp that the U.S. government set up for the General Van Pau and his team. I just momentarily forget that camp. It's a camp near Udon Thani, Thailand. But I momentarily forget the name of the camp. But later, when my parents came, they came to Nong Khai, Thailand. And there, they live. my two older brothers were still in Laos, so I had to go back to Mong Cai, you know, transfer from one camp to another camp to be with my parents. So in August 25, 1976, I left Mong Cai to Bangkok on my own.
You just left?
Yeah, I left to come to the U.S.
At that point, were you sponsored or you just walked out and left?
Well,
and if you don't feel comfortable with questions, then
that's fine. yeah, I have to apply for admission to the United States as a refugee. And my request was granted by the U.S. government. I had a sponsor in Arkansas by the name of Margaret Kepke. I might have the spelling of her last name somewhere of a German background. So I left Mong Cai on August 25, 1976, to Bangkok and stay there for my medical exam and so on. And I left.
You went alone?
I went alone.
Were your parents afraid for you?
They were. But there's no life in the refugee camp. So they let me come.
Two things I'm very interested in is how do individuals figure out that they need to go the next step, or, you know, you can have a family and usually there's one person who either figures it out themselves, says, I need to go, or in some cases, parents will say, I want this son or this daughter to go. When you look back on your life from that period, how do you think you figured out that you want to? You could say now there wasn't, you know, this wasn't the life.
Yeah, yeah.
But as a, you were what, 19 years old?
Yeah, I was 18 years old when I made the decision to come. My brothers and I were students in Laos, and so there's no schooling in the refugee camp. So for me and my brothers, there were no life for us without education. So it was easy for me and for my brother to say, there's no life for us, there's no future for us. We are students and we want to go to school. And there's no school here, so there's no future. That was very easy for us to determine. But for our parents, it was hard because they don't see future in another country or another place. Their minds, and the point of reference always back home, you know, in Laos. So they hesitate to let us come. So my father said, well, I was like the renegade son who was pushing the issue. And my father said, well, you are a disobedient son. You're so insistent on moving on with this. So I won't let your older brother and your younger brother come along, but you can go on your own. So I came on my own at that point in time.
Where were you in the continuum? You have an older brother than you, or
well,
still I'm asking?
Yeah, Yeah, my parents had 11 children. My father had a couple of wives, two passed away, and with my mom. So he had a couple of children. If you look at all the children, there's two younger than me, so I'm the number 9.
You said that your brother and you realized that you wanted to continue with your education.
Yeah.
Was it the older one when your father said, no, he's not going
to? He's the second son. Okay. The first son already got married at that point in time, so he has his own family. So the three bachelors, and my older brother, who is a few years older than I, myself, and the second to last children, the number 10. I would have been number 8 then, because he's number 10, is the youngest one. So the three sons, the form a small pack of brothers, we want to do to get on with life, to pursue our education.
But your parents said only yes to you because you were the
the renegade.
Pushing the limits, or?
Yeah. We were only in the camp for a year, so for them, the situation back in Laos was not finally settled, even though they knew that the communist government had come into power, and that there's no foreign government ready to support any resistance to go back and fight. The communist government then has taken over the government, but they were not sure what the future holds for them, and my parents, and so they just want to wait a little bit to see how things are gonna play out. But for us, waiting a couple years could be a long time. Our life, our future would have been impaired by just waiting for a couple of years. So that's how the decide to leave our parents and come to America. But with my father's telling my older brother and younger brother, no, not to go with your this renegade, rebellious son, I came along.
So you went from the camp to Bangkok?
Yeah.
And how long were you there for?
I was there for about a week. I came on September 3rd, 1976.
To Bangkok or here?
From Bangkok to America.
What did you think about this place you were going to go to? I mean, I don't know if you visualize or symbolize. I mean, for different people, some people think differently about the future and what was.
Well, the couple of references at that point that I had. One was the fact that I studied some English before, and so I had conversation with Americans about America in Laos, and also in the camp we have missionaries from the U.S. Who were working with us, that I had conversation with, and get a sense of what America is like. Also, there are pictures of America, American cities that you could look at, and there, as children growing up, you still have this curiosity about adventure that you want to go to, you know, cities or places that you want to go and see. And so I have that within me, but also with the prospect of continuing my education. And so I wanted to come. I talked it to the French man and woman about educational opportunities in Europe, in France. And they said, well, at your age, the best you could do if your language is good is go to trade school, you know. But my American missionaries would say, you can go to school at whatever age if you want to, you know. So America became the land, the promised land, if we can use some biblical terminology to describe, for me. So there's no certain country that I want to go. Canada was a third country that I considered, but the educational system in Canada is much more in line with the Europeans' educational system, even though they do have some free education as it is here in the States. I think it was not as attractive as the U.S. was to me at that point.
If you could explain a little bit how these different families became sponsors. For example, you say the one lady sponsored you from Arkansas. Did they like sign up with the churches and say, we'd be willing to do that? And then it's, you know, the organization says, okay, we have one person who's 19, do you want to sponsor him? How does it work?
I don't know.
And somebody else goes to Michigan and Minnesota.
I don't know how the government, the U.S. government, and the voluntary agencies who sponsor refugees work out those things in the States. I really don't know. But the organization that sponsored me was the American Fund for Czechoslovakia Refugees in New York City. And I don't know how that organization that is based in New York City found my sponsor in the little city of Jasper, Arkansas, in the Ozark Mountains. I really don't know how they made the connection. I never asked why that or how the connection was made.
Something true?
Yeah.
He also mentioned something about Czechoslovakia, and I'm wondering, I didn't ask him though what he meant by that they were.
Yeah, there was an organization. Yeah, there was a voluntary agency in New York by the name of American Funds for Czechoslovakia Refugees. Okay, it is apparently a non-profit organization that was helping to bring refugees into this country and help them to settle and help them find sponsors or whatever.
You never know who's coming together with.
No, that is something I never venture into.
As well, what their role was.
Yeah, there must be some connection between them and the federal government who paroled the refugees into the States. There must be some relationship there, because President Carter has to
parole the refugees, right?
Parole?
Yeah, P-A-R-O-L-E. The president, because refugees don't have a legal status.
Right.
They don't have a visa to come here under the regular immigration policy. So the U.S. government or President Carter has to, or four, maybe at that time, had to really sign a waiver to allow refugees to settle here. And once they are here in the States, then they can apply, if they qualify, for green card. And for me and the original group of people, we were not able to get any green cards until we are here in the States. We only had, our legal documents was an I-94.
I-94?
Yeah.
Which is what?
It's a form. It is a form. I-94 is a federal form for people who come into this country, and they have to fill the form, and the form is called the I-94 form. And as a refugee, you fill that form just like any person coming in here, and the U.S. government would just say, okay, this is a refugee, and you're allowed to live and work here. Yeah, that's the first one that we received. The second was a Social Security card with a permission to work. So we have the Social Security, right? We have the parole, the INS form I-94, and I suppose with that that is the permission to work. Okay, so those are the only two documents that we had as we come to this country.
And you went then to the Ozarks.
Yeah, I went to the Ozarks.
What was that like when you something?
Well,
did you get on an airplane or two airplanes or three?
Yeah, the plane landed in Seattle. Okay. Yeah, landed in Seattle. In the morning, and so I didn't see much of Seattle. But once I was driven from the airport to a motel to stay and sleep during the day, waiting for my flight at 4 o'clock in the or at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The next day. I think so, it's the next day. So I have to sleep, stay there over one day and one night, or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but then I had to fly to the Ozarks. And so I was living in Seattle for that day, and I could only see this guy's scrapers from where I was staying, and saw the beauty of the city. It was a wonderful sight, really, and also get a view of the ocean. So that was beautiful. That was beautiful. but once I get into the plane, they put me on the window seat. So as we taking off from Seattle, I can see the beauty of the whole city, you know. I think it was breathtaking at that time. I see the highways crisscrossing one another, and that was a wonderful, very special trip.
Then you Arkansas.
Yeah. I don't remember where I landed and got into a small plane. And then from that to Horizon, Arkansas, that is in the, that is in the Ozark Mountains. And as I left that city and going toward Horizon, Arkansas, it was just, okay, now out of the city, into the wood, and just into the wood, and I just see farmland and forest under there. It was a clear day in September. And when the plane landed in Arkansas, I stepped out of the plane. It was a small plane. There's snow. And then walk out into the waiting area. And there I met with my sponsor. She was alone, coming to greet me at the airport. I believe she was driving a Volkswagen what do you call that, the model that is that has stopped now?
The bus?
Yeah, the bus. She's driving a Volkswagen bus.
Or Beetle. What
do
they call it?
A Beetle, bug, whatever, yeah. Okay, so we then travel out of Horizon, Arkansas. I think it's spelled like Horizon. But
that's what I thought you were saying.
Yeah, but they pronounce differently in the South. Okay. And then we then go into Jasper. She did not live in town. She lived in a piece of land in the woods among 20 cats. She lived. Yeah.
20 cats?
Yeah, she had 20 cats. And she must be in her 50s.
And she lived alone?
Yeah, she lived alone. Her husband was working at the Chicago Tribune in Chicago. And so they married, but they live separate lives. He came home once or twice when I was there, twice. Once soon after I arrived, and then he went back to work, and then later he came to stay a little bit longer, and then he went back to work, and then I left. So for that period of 6 months from September to April in 1977 that I lived there, I saw him twice. So she lived alone in the wood, no neighbors. There was a wild cat that came every now and then to disturb her domestic cat. And she gave me her handgun, trying to shoot that wildcat. She had a pond.
It's making a movie. I mean, the visual. I mean, some people think visually. I happen to be a self-trained artist too, so I think very visually. But
yeah.
The whole setting of this.
I have some pictures, but I don't have it with me here.
And
she had a pond. Yeah, it is interesting. I didn't find this out until I went back with my wife in July to look at the area. She had since passed away, okay, a couple of years ago. And there was a lady who took care of her property and inherited everything that she owned. And she told me this. Just the lady who's living in the property now told me that Margaret, she was known by her nickname Peggy. Peggy and her husband, was that Jerry? I have to think a little bit about her husband's name. They did not have any children. So toward her older age, she befriended this woman and developed a relationship as if she want her to be, Peggy want her to be her own daughter. Okay, you can imagine. And she took me in, Peggy took me in with the intention of making me her son. I think that is part of the makeup from this woman who is there. And so she told me like this, "You're supposed to be the son she never had. I'm supposed to be the daughter she never had." So that may be the motivation why she would took me in.
It's very moving.
Yeah.
And how old was this woman about? Her age, or?
She is a couple years older than me. I think she said she is 58 now. So she's about 5 years older than me.
Amazing story.
Yeah, you might have to talk to her and get her side of the story. But so Peggy obviously had some reason to connect with the American Funds for Czechoslovakia refugees and brought me in as.
Could she have had Czech ancestry?
I don't know. Her husband had a German ancestry. Oh, wait a minute.
The Germans, I was just in Prague last summer.
Okay.
I was learning a little bit of history, but I mean, the Germans went in there. And
well, you might want to talk to this lady who's in the place. She knows more now. She told me that Margaret was a daughter of a famous family in Des Moines, Iowa, but she ran away. And maybe she was cut off from her own family because her family was a well-to-do family in Des Moines, Iowa. She went into Chicago and lived a life there. In the early days, she had a run with the law, according to this lady. And then she left Chicago to settle in the woods in Arkansas, where she found peace and tranquility and in life. You know, so she lived that life.
I wonder, and I wonder if she, you know, we all do things for our own
ego
and reasons why we that we understand or that we don't understand.
Yeah.
And I wonder the fact, it was almost as if she was a refugee from her own family. And if that somehow motivated her, in addition to wanting to parent.
Yeah, yeah.
If there's some kind of my philosophy is that, you know, we're all people, and we all have a story, and we all, you know, that's why the world is, to me, it's so crazy what people say and do and the hostilities and whatever, because everybody's, we're only here for a little time.
Yeah.
And I wonder if at some level she was...
That might have explained
it. It sounds as if she was a refugee. I mean, she was running for different reasons, but she must have been running, whether it was the law, whether it was her family.
Yeah. So there's maybe some connection. She might have felt in her own life that she really experienced the trauma of running away. Yeah. And so when she hear about the trauma of refugees from Southeast Asia, there might have been an emotional attachment to the trauma that refugees have, running away from their homeland and this and that. And that might have motivated. But then maybe another factor, like the lady mentioned, that Peggy supposed to, you know, have me as the son that she never had. So there may be multiple reasons.
And I don't even know the woman, so I'm just projecting. So did you go to school there while you were there, or you were just...
I went to the high school there, over a semester. She really wanted me to finish the year before I move on, but I said I was so homesick. I don't know if I would be able to live, you know, in that setting, that depressive setting. You're in the wood with the white cat and with the with the one wild cat.
Did you understand?
Yeah. But with the handgun, you cannot shoot that accurately, you know. And with the 20 or so domestic cats, and she had a pond there that I go and you know, feed the fish and this and that. Those are pretty much the activity that I was able to do. Just live with that cat and you know, go out to the pond and feed the fish and come back into her little mobile home. And
it was a mobile?
It was a mobile. Yeah. And
so how did you get in touch with, you said your cousins then came to Philadelphia?
Yeah.
How did you find them and stay in touch? And,
you know,
before email, before...
Yeah, we wrote letters. When we came, we gave them our sponsor's address. And when they came, they gave their sponsor's address. And so we write to so-and-so in care of, and the sponsor and the address, you know. That's how we correspond.
So the cousins came to Philly?
Yeah. Actually, western suburb of Philadelphia, near Downingtown, Pennsylvania. Yeah, I think he had relatives. Yeah.
So you communicated with them when they came? You said, I'm coming, or?
Yeah, I wrote to them. I'm so homesick, so lonely here. I don't know if I could live, you know, this life. And so I said, I'm going to go. I was in contact with the man who worked at the voluntary agency in New York. He has a toll-free number that I can call anytime.
With the Czechoslovakian?
Yeah. So they had a toll-free number, so I can call and talk to him. And I said, I'm so homesick, I don't think I can live here much longer in the Ozarks. And so I have cousins over there. The only way I'm going to survive is move with my cousin. And so he sent me money for the bus ticket. I think he might have purchased the bus ticket so that when I go to the bus station, I just pick up the ticket. I didn't have any money, okay? One of the missionaries who came to Laos by the name of Reverend Sawyers, he and his family live in close to Clinton, Illinois. And Clinton. And so I made a collect call to him and I said, I'm desperate. I cannot live here in the Ozark Mountain. I'm here at the bus station to go to Pennsylvania. It's going to take 2 days. I don't have any food to eat from here to there. The agency provide me with a bus fare, but that is that I don't have any spend money to buy food.
He was already in Wheaton, or he was...
He was already in Wheaton, but he was one of the missionaries that came to Laos. So he said, stay there in the bus station. I'm going to see what I can do, okay? So he called around to the churches in Harrison, Arkansas, and found a church who had $20. And the pastor came over and, are you so-and-so? I said, yes, I am. You know Reverend Sawyer in Illinois? I said, yes, I call him. And I know him. He said he called me and wanted me to come and bring $20 for you so you can, you know, buy food as you travel to Pennsylvania. I said, thank you. He prayed a blessing on me and then he left. But I got $20. That was a nice treat. Yeah.
It must have been difficult for Margaret to say goodbye to you.
It was. She was heartbroken. And I can sense her brokenness. She did show some anger, maybe because I wouldn't finish the year of schooling there. Maybe that her dream for me was not fulfilled, and that she had no way to really connect me to my people in such a way that will heal my emotional problem at the time. So there must be other things. As she was taking me to the bus station, she did not talk a lot, but it was, you know, you can see the expression on her face.
To go?
No, not yet.
So what happened when you went to Philly? You met your cousins there?
And then my cousin stayed with them for maybe a week or two. And I received a call from this man in New York saying, well, you are in the downtown area. I don't have any refugees that we sponsor there,
and I could not find any job for you there. But I already found a job in the Pocono Mountains at one of the resort there. There's two Laotian refugees working there and living there. So if you want, I can buy a bus ticket for you to travel to the Pocono Mountains. And if you want to go to school, since you are talking about going to school, there is a college there that is not too far from the resort. So I said, fine, I will go over there. So he bought me the bus ticket for me to go. And so I left my cousin there to go to the Pocono Mountains. I don't remember the name of the resort, but it's about maybe 15-20 minutes from town. It's
how
a ski resort.
From your cousin? 2 hours?
No, more than that. More than that. I think at that point in time, it would probably take a good 4 or 5 hours drive, because at that time, the road from Philadelphia to the Pocono Mountains is a small road, 30-45 miles per hour drive, and the speed limit was, not that great. There's no big highways, only this highway, the one two-lane highway.
So how long did you stay there?
I stayed there from 1977 to 1979. Finished a year and a half of college there. I came down to Philadelphia the summer of 1979 to make preparations for my parents who were coming, and I found a Baptist church in Philadelphia. To sponsor my parents.
Are they still there?
I don't know if that church is still there.
No,
I don't.
Your parents.
My parents, they passed away. So, in the summer of 1979, I moved, after the school year, I moved down there to work and also to make preparation for my parents to find a place for them, that kind of thing. So they came in the September 1979, almost 3 years to the day. So that's just a little bit over 3 years to that they are alive.
So how did you get to Michigan?
Well,
you went to California.
No. We went to, then from Philadelphia, we moved to Minnesota. And we lived many years in Minnesota, where I finished my bachelor degree in Minnesota.
What field?
Political science. And then I went to law school there. I worked as a lawyer for many years. When God called me to go to ministry, then I went back to school. I went to Bethel Seminary.
Where's that?
Bethel Seminary is also in St. Paul. And after Bethel, then I went to Luther Seminary, also in St. Paul. For my PhD in New Testament. So,
you were very serious about your education when you were young, and you, how do you say,
I think that was driven
by it.
Yeah, I was driven by learning. But I didn't plan to get the PhD. I just planned to get the master degree, and my thinking was, since I already had an advanced degree, you know, a law degree, I could serve God, do whatever I need to do. I thought that with my advanced degree, it would be adequate for me to just get a master degree, you know, and I want to serve God in whatever capacity I I'd be happy to give my life to Him. And so after the first year at Bethel Seminary, God moved me to go to the PhD program. So it wasn't something I desired. It was just God's will for me to do that. And so when I was accepted at Luther Seminary, they offered me a full tuition to go. So it was definitely a plan from God to get everything covered. Then I went to pastor a church in California.
So this is all relatively new. I mean, in the last, 10 years or so, that you've become involved with the ministry?
I left for the church in California in November 2002.
And then 2008.
Yeah.
And what kind of a church is this?
This is part of the Christian and Missionary Alliance.
Which is what?
It began with a Presbyterian pastor who was working with other pastors from different denominations to really plant churches in the cities, and also training people to do missions overseas. As the movement continued to grow and develop, the denomination was born by necessity, and so they just called it the Christian and Missionary Alliance. Originally, it was based in New York, and maybe a decade ago, it was moved to Colorado Springs. It is a Protestant movement. The church has a faith similar to the Southern Baptist Church of America.
this denomination grows more overseas than in the States. It has more ministries in Asia, and, Africa, in South America. I think the churches overseas are bigger than the church here in the U.S. It also spread to Canada. We have the Christian Missionary Alliance in the U.S., and there's also the Christian Missionary Alliance in Canada. There's a Christian Missionary Alliance in Australia, in the Philippines, in South America, just many places.
Now, fast forward, because you're going to have to go. You have to leave at 3:30 or be there at 3:30?
I have to leave here at 3:30.
There's more to talk about at another time about your personal story, which is very, very moving. I also need then to figure out and see how you might be able to help me with the community here, and give me some information that I can find with the Census Bureau, but I'm also needing to understand about the community in terms of families and the numbers of families.
Okay, what's up?
I mean, how do you say, a little bit about, which we're not going to finish today. But
yeah. We do have...
There's no book, and that's why they've asked me to do it.
Right.
About the Hmong in Michigan.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, they're the stories of people. But I need to be able to say, well, okay, so many hundred about came from Warren and Madison area, and somebody, and I'm going to be in touch with people in my
yeah.
too. But it's really that, I guess, what's discovering what the history is.
Yeah. Let me give you some people that you can talk to. Mr. Hang, H-A-N-G. Ku Hang. T-R-U, that's what I have.
Okay.
He is one for some reason I don't have his number. He's one of the original refugees who came to this state. He used to be a colonel in the CIA Army in Laos. But I will give you his brother-in-law's name and number. His brother-in-law is P-A-O-D-U-A. I think that is his name. Five eight six 256-0681.
Okay.
His email is pdx at rehabilitation. Rehab and Mobility Systems .com.
Rehab and
AMD. mobilitysystems.com. Okay. Mr. Pao Duo Xiong came maybe at the same time or soon after his brother-in-law, Mr. Han. So between those two, you would probably find out the original families who came here. Okay. And how many of them, and where to settle. So you may be able to, you know, do a pin drop on the map of Michigan and develop, okay, this is the original Hmong families. Mr. Xiong is Xiong, X-I-O-N-G. X like X-ray, I-O-N-G. Yeah. But it's pronounced Xiong.
The reason I'm looking like this last week?
Yeah.
Okay, there's a some kind of an Asian organization, not just for Hmong people, but MAPA or Mid Michigan Asian Pacific.
Okay.
Whatever. And there's a young woman who's a senior at Michigan State University, who I interviewed last week with the same last name. Now, I know there are several clans, and but this is how she spelled it, too.
Yeah.
And her parents are there in Lansing, and her grandmother, I guess.
Okay.
So he's, go ahead, he's...
He's a member of our church, but he had been involved in the community for many years, and he also one of the original refugees who came to the state of Michigan. So he can give you a moving story about the problems that they have here, the inability to find Asian groceries and food and whatnot, that they have to travel. He initially settled in Frankenmuth, and they have to travel down to Detroit to find groceries, to find rice, a bag of rice, and things
I
like that.
I heard there were a few families in Frankenmuth.
Yeah. Those are the original. I don't know if there's anyone left in Frankenmuth, but he was settled there. He may still have a home there in Frankenmuth.
So there's one other woman who I interviewed. I went last year at this time, or November, to the Michigan Hmong New Year Festival in Mason, Michigan.
Okay.
And I don't know how to pronounce her name. Mao? M-A-O. I think she had relatives in Frankenmuth. She lives in Warren. You don't know what I'm saying.
What?
Half cow?
I'm sorry, I can help you too.
So that's another person. Now, when I get ready to make contact, can I call you first so that you let him know?
No, I will let him know that I have given the his name to you, and that you'll be calling. So,
or email.
Yeah.
Okay.
Email too. So from there, you will probably get all the community leaders who had, you know, served the community since then until now. He probably can pick them out from, you know, a memory and just say, this is that, that is that, and he can give you the name of the community leaders who had really built this the Hmong community here, who settled here, and then how they get people to come from Thailand, from France, from all the states to move to Michigan, like Chu. I don't know if he first settled in Philadelphia and then moved here, or was there another family here was he one of the original Kuh family that settled here in Michigan?
I think he had cousins here, but I'm not.
Okay, so he
a lot of
he might have moved from Philadelphia to here.
I think, but I'm not sure.
Okay, so you get those original families. There's only like 18 clans in the Hmong community, right? So if you can say, okay, this clan who's the original settler here. This clan who's the original settler here.
That's a very good way to structure.
Yeah. So, okay, and then you go to talk to that person. Maybe that person is still here. Maybe he's passed away. But siblings or families or relatives may still be here. If the person has moved out of the state, you know, you can figure out whether you want to, you know, go and interview him, how he got his family to the state. And that might also help you develop a network of, okay, why they move out of the state and why are they in different state now. I know many have moved to North Carolina, South Carolina, some moved to Florida, some have moved to Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma. I'm sure some moved to California as well, because those are some of the stories that I got as the pastor of this church, you know. So,
how many families are part of the church?
Right now we have maybe about 120 families. I don't remember the exact families.
And what about other churches in the area?
There's a Baptist church. They said it's on 11 and close to Mound.
Close to what?
Mound Boulevard.
Oh, I passed that.
Yeah, Mound Boulevard and Van Dyke, close there. There's another Baptist church in Roseville.
When you mention these churches, does that mean that most or all of the people are of Hmong ancestry?
Yeah.
Okay. What's the next one?
There's another Alliance Church in Warren, too, but it's on the south side of highway. I think it's about 8 Mile and Hoover. There is a non-denominational church that was organized by one of the Hmong leader here, Mr. Hang, H-A-M-G.
That's the other name you gave me, the name,
yeah? Yeah, but it's a different Hang. The same Hang family, but it's a different Hang. I think it's near Van Dyke and 9 Mile. There's an Alliance Church in Pontiac. There is a Assembly of God Church somewhere here in town. I don't know if they worship at a particular facility. I don't know, but they I know there is a Assembly of God Church. There's also a Catholic Fellowship. I don't know what they worship. Those are the churches that I know she exists.
What you were saying earlier, I don't know if you said it or I was thinking it, I think you were saying, I think I need to get a large map of Michigan. I mean, even broader, get a large map, and then start putting
pin drop.
That's what you, yeah. Okay, I didn't know what it was called. Because otherwise it's, you know,
yes,
confusing.
Yeah, confusing. You need to get the original. you know, that there's only 18 clans, right? So, get okay on this clan. Let me give you the clan names, okay? You got the Ku, okay? You got the Hang. You got the Xiong, X-I-O-N-G. Okay, there's another clan name by my last name, Tao. There's the Yang, Y-A-N-G. There's the Vang, V-A-N-G. The Li, L-E-E, sometimes it's spelled L-Y. There's a Kong, K-O-N-G. The Kong also go by another name, S-O-U-N-G. Kong and Song do the same clan. There's the Pa, P-H-A clan. There's the Cheng, C-H-A-N-G clan. But there's another clan, C-H-E-N-G. There's the Moa, M-O-U-A. There's the Her, H-E-R or H-E-U. That does spell. There's the Lo, L-O, sometimes the spell L-O-R.
Hello, what?
L-O-R. Okay, or just spell L-O, okay? There are two different spellings there. Let's see, do I miss anyone? The Vu, V-U-E. I have pretty much. How many? I got 15 out of them.
A good start.
Okay. Then when you go talk to Mr. Pao Duo, you can ask him or the original, some of the original members here. Okay. Of this clan, who was the first? Of that clan, who's the first? Of that clan, who's first? And where? And you get them on the map on Michigan and. You can ask question, okay, and these are 1976 people. That's the original group that came here, 1976. Of the 1976 people who came here to Michigan, so where are they at? So you get the first group, okay, these are the 1976. Well, you might want to do 1976 to 1979, that is the original group of people. The people who came here with some status, either as a student or someone who worked with the U.S. government. So that's the original group. And from 1979 to 1983, that's the family reunification component. So you will see a lot of the family coming in. Like me, I bring my family in 1979, right? So 1976 to 78, 79, the early part were probably the original people who worked for the U.S. government or had some connection or students. Yeah. And then from 1979 to 83 is the family reunification, okay, movement. The original people who came here, they brought in their families. From 1983 forward, the floodgate is pretty much open.
What is open?
Floodgate. It's open because Thailand was pushing refugees out of Thailand. You know? So, with that, the U.S. government was put in a box. We either have to settle all these refugees who are in Thailand, even though they have not worked with us, but they are part of the impact of our work in China, in Laos. So these people, if they send back to, they are sent back to Laos, they may suffer persecutions and whatnot. So the U.S. government made a decision to bring all the Hmong refugees in. And so everyone who wants to come are welcome to come after 1983 or so.
So they truly allowed the surge.
Yeah. The refugees in Thailand, the Hmong
wanted refugees, to come could come.
Yeah.
They weren't excluding.
Not excluding. Except the, those who have medical problems or maybe tied to the communists or whatever, those may be excluded. But just about anyone who wants to come can come. So we have those three phases of Hmong refugees coming to this country.
You said you majored in political science. I was going to say, how much anthropology did you study too?
Oh, just a couple classes.
This is really, really helpful. I know you have to.
Okay. So with that, you can talk. You can say, okay, first phase, these are the people. Second phase, these are the families that come and where they settle. And then from 1983, there's a lot of, you know, migration within the states, people moving in and out. And you will see a community springing up in the state of Michigan. And from there you can say, okay, now, there's a burgeoning of populations in the Detroit area. What are the reasons? You know, you can go through that. What are the reasons why? And you may be able to attribute to a couple of community leaders, like the coup, why the coups are all moving into the Detroit area. Because they have a community leader, a leader who can call the friends together and move everyone here. You know, like the Hank family, all the Hank pretty much moved out from all the states to come to Michigan because Mr. Hank, who was the second in command under General Van Kao, he lived here and he wanted his people to be here. He was the intelligence officer, the Hmong intelligence officer serving under the CIA. He was a Hank, so he brought all his clan here. You might want to know about the Yang, why they're here, who are the community leaders. So then you have a picture not only how people settle, but the force that bring people in here.
I will send you a typed up form that gives me permission to use your materials.
Sure.
But you also need to let you know that before anything is published, you go over it, please, because I don't want to make any mistakes. So that even though you're allowing me to use the materials, you still have it. I mean, this could be a year from now. It is a complicated process.
Yeah.
So if that's okay with you, I didn't bring an official form, but right now I'll just.
That's fine.
Okay. Yeah,
that's fine. You can do that. Let me add a couple of things for you to look at. So we talked about the original people here, and the second group. Is the leaders who have influenced their clan to the extent that they move other people within their clan from other states to come here. Okay, so we talked about the first of the original people who worked with the Americans. The second group is family unification, but family. Reunification has two forces. One is the refugees here bringing people from Thailand, from the refugees camp. But at the same time, that force the family reunification also bring in refugees from all the states who come here. And the community leaders were the forces that bring people in here.
This is really helpful.
Okay.
And you understand what I need to do, so it's really
sure. The third thing is maybe the economy, and you might want to ask questions about what contribute to the stability of the community here, or what was employment like, was the school like, what was the social safety network was like.
Social?
Yes, social, like.
Networking?
Yeah, social networking. And the safety net, the social safety net, like welfare, those kind of things. And the kind of support that they receive from churches, from nonprofit organization, to build up the community here.
The churches and other, what do you say?
Nonprofit organizations that really help maintain the community, stabilize the community here. For example, Lutheran Social Services or Catholic Charities, did they have refugee programs in which they have maybe refugee resettlement workers there who help with translations, who help with bringing people to the hospitals and things like that, you know, that are very important factors in maintaining the stability of the community here, besides employment. You might want to look at another social service area, such as adult education. Okay, what kind of education is provided to these refugees when they first arrive here? And when you talk to Population and other community leaders like that, they'll be able to tell you and give you a lead. So your book will be well-rounded and and more interesting.
Okay, can you just... All I said for now is I give Martha Bloomfield permission to interview me and use my materials for books and other educational publications. I'll send you an official list. Thank you so much. This last part is going to help a lot, and that's the more difficult piece for me, to structure it.
Yeah.
But I'm very grateful to you for